This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community. Get your motor
running. Fender Bender on Joy 94.9, revving up the weekends with news and views on all things motoring.
Oh, good afternoon. Good afternoon. My name is Daniel Gardner and you're listening to Fender Bender on Joy 94.9. Good afternoon. It is a fabulous Saturday afternoon out there. Thank you so much to the fabulous team at Critical Hit. Another fully gamed up episode there. We are talking today on Fender Bender. It is a special episode, and if you are even slightly into cars, you will know exactly what it's going to be a special of. Of course, the Tokyo Motor Show is on as we speak. A couple of us were very lucky enough to be there in person, and we will be bringing you all of the action, all of the reels, all of the concepts, and so much more from the Tokyo Show. It probably is an opportune moment to introduce my guest. Thank you very much, Mike Costello, a regular now of Fender Bender. Actually, when I say regular, that's slightly patronising. You've been on the show longer than I have.
Yeah, maybe. Is it? Yes.
How many Tokyo shows have you been to?
Oh, this is only my second.
Okay.
It's only every 2 years.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. And I wasn't laughing at you. I was admiring the fact that the end of that song coincided with us being introduced to the sound of canned applause.
That was nice,
which
wasn't it?
I think we should make that a regular thing.
Okay, I'll try and... there's probably a sound effect in there somewhere.
Yeah.
I think all I've got at the moment is some skidding, which, you know, it's appropriate, but probably a little bit distasteful. Thank you, Mike. Good to have you back. And we'll be talking about your escapades in Japan. And we are also joined in the studio by the fabulous Kez Casey, who is also now, I'm very pleased to say, quite a regular attendee of Fender Bender. How are you, sir?
Very good.
Excellent. Now, you were one of the unfortunate souls who had to be back in Australia manning the fort. Now, we go to these shows and say, you know, oh God, it's such hard work, you know, wandering around all day talking. Actually, the hard work is being back here and picking up all the bits that you can't cover when you're at the motor show. So you've been working harder than anyone while you're back here, have you not?
Absolutely. Well, you guys have been lounging around, whooping it up in Tokyo. Somebody stayed and did all the hard work.
Exactly, and that was you.
That was me.
In amongst a handful of other journalists. So I'll be talking to you both guys. We'll be covering off some of the news that came out of Tokyo. We'll also be talking about the concepts and the production versions that came out. And Mike and I, we were both lucky enough to have a little drive while we were there of some important cars, and we'll be talking about that a little bit later. In the meantime, though, let's get stuck into some of the news.
Fender Bender, guaranteed to leave skid marks?
Horrid. Okay, kicking off with, now, VW, we talk about Volkswagen virtually every week now on Fender Bender because they have been a little bit naughty with their emissions scandal. We won't cover off the details too much because otherwise it would be pretty much a 5-minute segment every week. But the big news here is at the Tokyo Motor Show, Volkswagen had an important announcement to make, and that was that they have come up with a fix for their smoky engines that are belching out way too much emissions, and they have now said that they have come up with a fix for it.
Did they say what that fix was?
No.
Suspicious.
Because they aren't saying... Well, look, what's the suggestion? We were talking about this off air, and we think they haven't got one yet.
I think they're just making it up.
Do you?
Yeah.
But how can they... I mean, well, they must have been working...
They didn't say we've got a fix tomorrow. They said we've got a fix that will start rolling out in January. So there's some poor engineer working his bum off in Germany going, oh man, I've got like 2 months to fix this.
Right.
And then I'm going to go out there and I'm going to say, come January, they'll say there's been a production delay.
Yeah, okay.
We're going to make it March, make it April.
So I think we think they're buying time at the moment, do we?
I think they are.
Well, I mean, they could fix it right now if they had to, but the issue is fixing it in a way that doesn't send them bankrupt and that can be rolled out en masse, because there's 11 million cars affected and you have to do it cheap enough that it literally doesn't drain all your coffers. So I think, I'm sure they could fix it easily enough, but the logistics around it are the hard bits.
And
so
I can forgive them that. I mean, I think if they completely were on record and came out with that, and if you're quite right, Mike, I think people would forgive them because, you know, like, if they did say, okay, we're going to do it all in one shot, they'd probably only get through about 10% of the cars that need doing, and then they go bust, and 90% of the cars wouldn't get fixed. So I think if they just said, look, we need time to do this. I know we're Volkswagen, we've got squillions of dollars, but we do need time to fix this.
I would suggest the fact that they chose to make this announcement at the Tokyo Motor Show rather than in Europe was, so when you're in the motoring journalist scene, you notice certain countries have certain ways of interviewing and getting the most they can out of executives. When an announcement is made in Europe, they're grilled remorselessly by, you know, There's business journalists and environmental journalists are going to ask the hard questions. At the Tokyo Motor Show, you can do a sound bite and then you can leave the stage and you can kind of avoid the hard follow-up questions. And I think it's really telling that they maybe did it in Tokyo rather than somewhere else.
I see.
You know, this is all just me spitballing and it's not me actually accusing them of anything, but it just seems like an interesting place to make the announcement.
That makes sense in a lot of ways, although the attendance at the Volkswagen stand would suggest otherwise. I mean, they were absolutely inundated. I think everyone was expecting them to say something, and if they didn't say something, there were going to be a lot of questions asked. So, yeah, they're not going to get away with this, are they, really?
No.
Okay. All right, watch this space, because they do say that the fix is going to be, in majority of cases, software, but in some cases it will need to be hardware. They're going to say exactly what they're doing about it, a little bit more detail later. And, of course, you will hear all about it on Fenderbender. Also, Land Rover, at the launch, or at least the showing of their F-Pace, which is, sorry, the Jaguar F-Pace, Jaguar Land Rover, same company these days, made an announcement saying that they were going to be the first people. Now, we hear a lot and talk a lot on Fenderbender about autonomous cars, but Land Rover have gone on record at the Tokyo show saying they're going to be the first people to make an autonomous off-roader. Hey, what about that?
Well, I think the benefits of this are, you know, that you can, if there's a, you know, you're not quite sure whether your car can make it, you don't quite feel safe, you can get out and watch your car go up the ravine or make it through that tricky part. But
isn't, that is so cool.
Isn't the fun in off-roading doing the off-roading?
True.
Not to be a traditionalist, but it's like a race car that drives itself and you're just sitting in it. Isn't the engagement what makes off-roading fun? Unless it's purely utilitarian and you're just trying to get somewhere.
And who realistically does
that? No, because there's roads. So the only reason you go on off-road trails is because you want the challenge. So it seems like a kind of pointless mission. I don't get why they're doing it.
Okay, agreed.
Other than just to say, hey, we can.
I have never really looked at it like that. But then I suppose, go on.
Can I also point out that nobody really thought about this? Say, for example, you get out of your car and you let it autonomously cross a river.
How do you get after it?
Then your car is on the other side of the river. And where are you? You're on the wet side to get to your... That makes no sense. Like, nobody at Land Rover actually gave this any decent thought.
That is a really excellent point. I love that. Well, okay, so the technology they've already not rolled out, but they've demonstrated, is that you can get an application on your smartphone, you can drive your Range Rover effectively like a really big expensive remote control car. So if you did make the mistake, as Kes points out, I love that, or just let it, you know, you've all seen people flying radio control planes and they get out of range. I see it like the Range Rover out of range. It's like, oh god.
But also, how hard is it to control a regular remote control car? You end up crashing it into stuff and going, what the hell is going to be, just rogue Range Rovers just smashing into other cars?
So good on you, Range Rover, Land Rover. That's it's a great idea, but utterly pointless. Citroen. Well, I had a little chat with Citroen while I was there, and you know how the DS brand has now separated from Citroen?
Well, recently did the Australian launch of very car,
That's right. So they've got the DS5 here. Citroen features nowhere in the brand of DS anymore. So they're two separate things. DS now has got a pretty good deal because they're just pursuing entirely as a more premium brand to go against the Germans. But I asked the CEO of Citroen Global, a fabulous lady called Linda Jackson. I really wanted it, when I was talking to her, I really wanted to have to apologise for something, because then I could say, I'm sorry, Miss Jackson. Anyway.
You would have been an outcast among your fellow members if you had it on that.
Upstage! Dan was upstage. I said, you know, in losing DS, have you kind of lost an important asset? And she said, actually, no. This is the best thing that's ever happened to Citroen. We've now got an opportunity to completely reinvent ourselves and be way more fun than we ever have been. She said, like the Cactus, which is coming to Australia next year or earlier.
Priced from $27,000, by the way.
There you go. Thank
cheap
you, Mike.
Chips.
She said, we're going to be doing way more cars like that now. And so I said, well, Aircross, which is the proper SUV, and she said, we really want that car. So we could be seeing with the rebrand, instead of them actually losing an important asset, they're going to be able to access and develop way more fun cars.
It's very clear what they're doing, isn't it? Like, the PSA group, Peugeot is the Volkswagen competitor, Citroen is the Skoda competitor, and DS is the Audi competitor. It's exactly the same strategy. One's luxury, one's a bit funky and out there, and one is, you know, very sort of safe and reliable and efficient and all those things. It's sort of an interesting tack that they're taking.
Yeah. All right, gentlemen, I'm going to have a quick break. Not for anything in particular. You know, I don't need a wee or a cup of tea or anything. I just would like to play some...
A cup of tea would be all right.
That's fine. Yeah. Stay with us, though. Stay with us. We're not going anywhere until 5 o'clock. So you're on Fenderbender on Joy 94.9. Before the break, we were talking all things news out of the Tokyo Motor Show. And we want to stay on the news just for a few moments longer because, Mike, you had a chat with the main man of Mitsubishi and got an update on their state of play.
Yeah.
It wasn't great news, was it?
Yes. Aikawa-san, I have spoken to a couple of times about. Because Mitsubishi is one of those companies that, you know, in the 90s was iconic for things like the Evos, and it was doing some radical stuff. And just lately, its cars are efficient and safe and all those things. But it also isn't a company that's exactly on the cutting edge of a lot of things. And two things that stand out are the fact that the Lancer is two generations old now, and they're still making it, and it's hopelessly outclassed by newer small cars like the Golf and the Focus, and the Pajero, which is one of the most famous names in the business, but it's 16 years old now in its current generation.
Is that how old it is?
Yeah, 1999 that shape launched. Whoa. And it's had updates, and they're, you know, tweaking it and adding new infotainment and all that sort of stuff. It's fundamentally the same car, and that is ancient. That is Methuselah age in the modern era of automotive engineering. And so the question to pose to Mitsubishi, obviously, was, well, where's your new Lancer and where's your new Pajero? And the bad news is there's no new version of either in sight for years
yet. What are they going to do?
Well, they tried to do a deal with Renault-Nissan to source a platform to make a new Lancer on, because the company says it's quite small. It can't afford to make a new car by itself. It has to get help from somewhere else. That deal fell through. The company says it's really trying to find a new partner, and it just can't do it. And it's admitted that it has nothing on the cards, which is a bit depressing for any fan of the Lancer who wants to see a new one. You're going to have to wait a long time, and it may never happen at all. And it's the same story with Pajero. The company was, you know, it released a concept 2 years ago that was showing the supposed next Pajero. Nothing has materialized since, and the company now admits it's at least 3, 4, 5 years away from anything new in that area. And again, it may not happen at all either.
See, now this is a worry, isn't it? Because Mitsubishi has, it's basically flying on empty, but it's relying on the last fumes in the tank of people who like the brand. And as we saw with the Triton, you know, when that was running out before the new one arrived, people were buying that because the price was so cheap, been around for so long, they managed to cut the price down to virtually free. People love the Triton, and it was just surviving entirely on that reputation and the price.
Yeah, and it's not a good way to build your brand. And the company did say it's got one new model coming, which is going to sit between the ASX and the Outlander, so another sort of smallish SUV, which is where all the buyers in the market are going now. The next ASX will get a bit smaller. There'll be this new one in the middle, and there'll be the Outlander, and that'll be the family, right? But the two most famous models that that company makes are the Lancer and the Pajero, and there is nothing happening there. And it's a little bit kind of, you know, challenging to see how the company... I mean, the whole point of business, as Mazda showed when it was in trouble, is when you're in big financial trouble, you actually invest, you get a line of credit somehow, and you make new product, you get new buyers to your brand, and then you dig yourself out of a hole that way. It's kind of sad to see what's happening to Mitsubishi.
So what's the worst case? What happens, you know, if they can't find someone to pair up with for the new Lancer, if they can't find the development cash for another Pajero, what happens? Do they just disappear?
Well, Mitsubishi's largely focused on the ASEAN region now, which is, you know, largely developing market region. So what might happen is it starts making cars for, you know, India and Indonesia and developing markets, but those vehicles tend to not translate to standards that we'd sell cars in markets like ours in Europe and America. So you might see Mitsubishi just completely refocus. It'll still be around, but as to whether it can play in markets like ours long term, who knows? Who knows?
Interesting. We'll watch this space. Poor Mitsubishi. That was the news!
Don't forget to fasten your seatbelt. You are listening to Fender Bender on Joy 94.9.
Now, a motor show wouldn't be a motor show without a radical new concept or two, and Tokyo was absolutely no exception this year. There were a whole host of weird and wacky machines that were debuted for the first time. That's actually a tautology, isn't it? Debuted for the first time? Okay, so pretend you didn't hear that. So, yes, the show this year was very colourful indeed. The Japanese are really good at a weird and outlandish concept. And the one that everyone was waiting for, which wasn't particularly weird and outlandish, but was probably the talk of the show, Mazda and their eagerly and long-awaited concept RX Vision. Now, this car is important for a variety of reasons, most notably that they've confirmed it will mark the return of rotary power, or as I really like saying on this show, the Wankel engine. Now, what do we think of this?
It's an impressive looking thing.
Hang on. We've got Kez, who is a Mazda owner.
I have one small problem with the RX Vision concept. Now, I love the idea of a rotary powered car, and I love that Mazda has, after every other manufacturer has given up on it in the past, Mazda is the sole manufacturer that still has engineers working on making the rotary acceptable in terms of emissions and reliability, which are two things that's not particularly great for. They haven't said much about this engine. So we don't know if it's going to be turbocharged. We don't know if it's going to be partly hybridized. Mm-hmm. But they are building this car on a unique platform. It doesn't share any parts with anything else in the Mazda range. That's an expensive endeavour, and to do that, it means that they will not be building another MPS, and that's why I have a problem.
Oh, I see.
Because I have an MPS, and I want another one, and there isn't one to replace it with.
But okay, but if they potentially, you know, Mazda's doing right, this brilliant brand in Australia, and making a bit of cash here. If they offer a sports car that could potentially, you know, bump funds up a little bit, then maybe they find the money and the notoriety to put, perhaps, you know, put the, pump that into a new MPS for you, Kez?
To be honest, this thing is absolutely gorgeous and it will sell its socks off if they can manage to build it. No word on price or spec or anything like that yet. Like, it's purely just a concept, but buyers would fall over themselves to buy one if they managed to put it in production.
That is the concept. That is the danger, because they're putting it on its own platform and it's got technology that took a lot of time and investment and resources to come up with to get the rotary effective in the modern era. All those things tell me that it's going to be a really expensive car.
Yeah.
Because there's so many costs associated with the development. Unless the company absorbs some of those, it's going to be a really high-end model, which is great. But whether Mazda can get away with selling an exotic priced car, because in my mind, it has to be like the RX-7 was, which is relatively affordable. Yeah. Not because it's not going to be great, but because that's the sort of car that you sort of expect from Mazda, like a semi-premium performance car rather than a really high-end exotic.
Okay, so let's have a speculate then. If we know what size the car is now, because we've seen it, you know, it'll be loosely the same size. Hopefully it retains a lot of those beautiful design features. It's a classic front-engine rear-drive sports car coupe. What would you pay for a car like that with rotary performance? We're expecting it to be, you know, it'll be, you know, 300 horsepower, sort of, what's that, you know, if it's a hybrid, it might be a bit more. What would you pay for a car of that performance and that size and looks like that?
70 or 80 grand.
Really?
Yeah.
It's not a lot.
No.
It's not, is it?
So that's the same as a 370Z Nissan.
No, a little more. Wouldn't pay Porsche 911 money, would you? The Honda NSX is going to cost that kind of money. Yeah. Hybridized Japanese supercar.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say Honda NSX, Nissan GT-R, if they can get the technology right and they can get the performance right, if this thing is a turbocharged rotary, which can deliver fairly impressive performance, I think they can get away with money somewhere in between that GTR to NSX level. So,
okay. Yeah, so we're talking just over 100 grand sort of thing.
I'm thinking more like 150 to 200. They'll drop it in that range. But with impressive driver assistance technology, like this thing will be able to lap race tracks, you know, in blistering times.
Okay. So I'm sort of in that school of thinking as well. I think if the car looks like that and is that size and has that performance to boot, coming from a motor journalist who earns $15 every 3 years, you know, I can't really talk about buying any car, but that for me looks like $100-150 grand worth of car.
If it arrives like the RX-8, which was the last rotary powered car with 180 kilowatts and enormous fuel consumption, then they have no chance.
Yeah.
But if they can do something really revolutionary with it, it should be good.
Okay. All right, moving on to another absolutely show-stopping car. Now, this was a real surprise for the show. Yamaha is a company mostly associated with making two-wheeled vehicles. They do the odd side-by-side and find a little off-road kind of thing.
And musical instruments.
True. And they had a few of those at the display as well. There's a weird drum kit you could get in. It was mm-hmm. like a sphere drum kit.
I'd love to.
Did you see anyone playing it? It was really cool.
Yeah, at the opening of the car, I had a guy playing it. It was amazing.
Awesome. I arrived a bit late. But the reason we were there, Mike, was to see their absolute centerpiece, which was a sports car. And not anything like a motorbike or an off-road vehicle. This was a proper little sort of old Suzuki Cappuccino-sized proper little rear-engine sports
car. It's actually the same size as a Mazda MX-5. It's not as small as you think it is.
Okay,
it's about 4 meters long. And it's so cool to see, because Yamaha has basically just... It made a concept city car 2 years ago, but this is something else entirely. But it's basically come out and just schooled more established car brands and how to make a desirable little sports car. We've seen so many companies talk about doing it, and a few have. Mm. Sure, the 86 comes to mind, and the MX-5 comes to mind. But this thing, it looks like a mini Pagani. It was developed by the guy who did the McLaren F1, Gordon Murray. It's got a carbon fibre tub like a race car. It's some of the fine detailing in the cabin is unbelievably good. Most importantly, the display car had a trumpet on the parcel shelf because of the Yamaha musical connection.
I saw that. Wasn't that brilliant?
Because yeah. Japan, I guess. But seriously, this thing, it'll probably have a little motorbike engine, yeah. like a 1,000cc triple, somewhere around that market. Mm-hmm. Weighs 750 kilos, which yep. is nothing. It looks amazing. And it's Yamaha.
And as you say, you know, looking at the technology that they've already clearly put into the car, this is not just a clay model. It's way further down the line.
This is a like looking at the detail yeah. on this car, looking at the fact that it's got production brakes, production suspension, yeah. production. It's got. It is. You could drive that thing off the stand. This yeah. was not like a you know, like you say, a glorified. You know, model yeah. with nothing underneath.
Yeah,
like,
they're
this,
serious
this
about it.
The real
I really,
deal.
Really want to see this thing go into production. It's like an MR2, but they've turned up the dial even yeah. further. Like you say, carbon fiber production, construction, and things like that. But if they do not put the 1 liter engine out of the R1 sport bike in it, they are completely and utterly nuts. Like if that thing were able to rev to 14,000 RPM.
Can you imagine?
That would just be the greatest micro sports car in history.
Well, they absolutely have. I mean, that would make sense as the only engine because it's the biggest engine the company currently does. And surely that's the one that they put in it. Because the little city car they had 2 years ago was an EV. Now, this isn't going to be an EV. It wouldn't make any sense to make it an
EV. No, it's going to be a lovely fuel-guzzling maniac.
Yeah, there's
a little noisy, revving
three cylinder.
There's an outside chance, though, that it might be because Yamaha has built a lot of high-performance engines for Toyota. So could the bones for this engine come from, say, a Yaris, perhaps?
Maybe. Well, actually...
Oh, come on.
With a high-revving, high-compression head, okay. which is what Yamaha does and yeah. does really well.
The Gordon Murray design says that its carbon fibre tub is going to be quite affordable by those standards, so yeah. it could keep the cost down that way. Don't forget, Yamaha did the most amazing V8 engine in the 90s and 2000s for Volvo S80, among others.
Yeah.
So Yamaha has form when it comes to this sort of thing. I just love the fact that it's not a brand you normally associate with four wheels, like you said, Dan, and they've come out and done something amazing, and it's brilliant.
Okay, let's hope we see it on Australian soil if it actually ends up going to production. But as I say, fingers crossed, we'd love to see this. Okay, very quickly, how much do you reckon something like that would be worth?
Ooh,
what would you pay for that? Who does it go up against?
I mean, well, it's the size of an MX-5,
yeah,
so you'd have to say something around that mark, sort of mid-30s, you'd yeah. think.
Okay,
who knows?
That'd be good. Or, you know, is it even
more.
Like Lotus competitor? I mean, it's
yes, it could be a Lotus Elise competitor, absolutely.
So
you'd get
pretty
grand.
Light and pretty exotic, but I wouldn't think Lotus money. I'd think maybe $50,000.
It is a Yamaha, after all.
Yeah, I'd benchmark it around that, and I reckon that's what they'd sell it at, but it depends what engine they put in it and what okay. it can deliver performance.
If it was mine, the first thing I would do is modify the tailpipe to be the trumpet. I'd obviously use a Yamaha trumpet.
Did you guys make sure that the trumpet isn't actually there instead of a horn? Maybe that's what you've got to honk at people.
That'll be so good. Okay, fingers crossed that that's what they do. Some nice little design tweaks. You are listening to Fender Bender on Joy 94.9. Stay with us. We'll be back after this short break. Before the break, you heard Big in Japan by Martin Solvig. And someone else who was big in Japan is Mike Costello. He's 6'4". He was literally big in Japan.
Yeah.
And while you were there, Mike, you were before the break. We were talking about all the concepts and things that were happening at the show, but we were there to do a little drive, weren't we? We were actually there to you know get behind the wheel of something, not just look and dribble over lovely concepts and new cars. And you drove something that was potentially critical for a company called Mitsubishi, which you were talking about earlier. And you drove it also somewhere very special. Tell us about it.
Yes, I was a little bit mean on Mitsubishi before, you know. I mean, and I think we shouldn't forget the fact that it is the fifth biggest selling brand in Australia, based on things like the Triton that we talked about, and the Triton-based SUV called the Challenger. Although it's not actually called the Challenger anymore, it's now called the Pajero Sport. And that's what I drove near Mount Fuji, on the footsteps of the famous Mount Fuji.
Cool.
Not that I saw any of Mount Fuji because it was covered in fog and cloud, which is a bit of a shame. But Mitsubishi has this amazing off-road track in the footsteps of Mount Fuji. Pajero Sport, based on the new Triton, much improved car, going to go up against recently launched things like the Ford Everest, the Toyota Fortuner, and established rugged off-roaders like the Isuzu MU-X. And it really fills that gap where we talked before about the current Pajeros getting on a bit, still getting around, still off a 7-seat, still on the market, but this is kind of a supplementary car to that.
Yeah.
And the brand has much higher hopes for it, because the Challenger, it was a good, affordable, rugged, reliable car, but it never really set the world on fire in terms of sales, in terms of traction. This new one, massive improvement in every way. It's much more refined than before. It's more luxurious and up-spec before. Every variant will get Apple CarPlay and Android Auto.
Oh, cool.
still tough as nails off-road, really clever off-road technology. I was lucky enough to actually go on a very quick jaunt around this purpose-made circuit with a Dakar rally champion.
No way.
Who absolutely trashed the living hell out of a completely stock version of this car.
Really?
Gave it hell and the thing handled it.
Oh, cool.
Very impressive. Just the fact we never hit the bump stops once, the suspension compliance and the use of the torque vectoring technology off-road was really pretty high-end stuff.
Wow, this you're using all kinds of like four-wheel drive turns and stuff. Then I didn't understand a word of it.
This is the sort of car Mitsubishi does really well. Rugged, tough off-roaders sure. that just get the bloody job done. But it does have some nods to modernity. It's the first Mitsubishi ever with an 8-speed automatic transmission. It's the first Mitsubishi with a blind spot monitor. It's right. got an electric park brake. It's got hill descent control. It's got some stuff that you don't typically see in this class of vehicle. And while I haven't driven it on local roads, I have spent time in the Everest and the Fortuna, and I can say this thing is definitely a viable competitor to those cars. It's a massive step up on what the Challenger was. So, pretty impressive.
So, have they spent all their money on it, though?
Possibly.
No, so it's just like the swan song for Mitsubishi. They're like, we're going to do one last really good car.
My calls before about Mitsubishi focusing on the ASEAN area might be true in some ways, but this is definitely a global car, and it deserves to be a global car because it actually is a very good bit of kit.
And does that mean we're going to get it in Australia?
Absolutely. It launches in December.
Great.
It'll probably be starting at around 40k. It'll go up to about 50k, somewhere around there. Triton's hugely popular. This thing will be way more popular than its predecessor. Not everyone is enamored with the styling.
Okay.
It's quite, you know, but styling's so subjective, I don't want to really comment on that.
It does have a kind of unusual set of tail lights, though.
It really does. Some are going to hate it, some are going to love it. I've heard mixed feelings on the car. It's certainly not conventional looking, but, you know, it tows 3 and a bit tons. It's tough, it's rugged, it's refined, it's a step up. And this is the sort of car that Aussies love to buy. And, you know, talking to some off-road enthusiasts, like regularly in forums and clubs and things like that, they love the Challenger.
Yep.
And they'll like the Pajero Sport.
Okay.
It's ready to roll.
So who's going to buy it here? Will it be existing Pajero owners? Are they looking to conquest sales from other brands?
Potentially. There's a strong following in the hardcore off-road scene to modify them that'll buy it. People who want to tow horse floats and big boats will buy it. Grey nomads who want to drive around the country will buy it. People who are adventurous. You're not going to buy this if you want to get something like a Santa Fe, which is a bit softer, car-based, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Inherently, these cars are not going to be quite as refined on the road because they're designed to go off it.
Okay.
So it's going to be that kind of buyer who wants to actually get something dirty every
That was going to be my next question. It's like the old Holden Colorado thing, isn't it? It's a great car off-road, but as soon as you try and drive it on anything smooth, it's horrendous.
But the Pajero Sport is a significantly better car than the Holden.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And not real fair comparison. Is it smaller or is it around about the same size?
No, around the same size.
Okay.
Yeah. It's a fairly big car, not quite as big as a Pajero. And I think that having the Pajero Sport name is quite clever because people know the Pajero name really, really well. And this is kind of tapping into that.
Right.
Okay. So, well done, Mitsubishi. You know, it's a brand that obviously cops a bit every now and then, but on this occasion...
Yeah, from you, just earlier.
Well, yes, exactly. But this is genuinely, and I say it with all honesty, it's a really, really good effort.
Okay. Looking forward to getting it here.
I have one little thing, though, that I find a little bit perplexing that Mitsubishi is going to do when the car arrives in Australia. Now, they have a 7-seat version of the Outlander, and the Pajero offers 7 seats, and overseas, the Pajero Sport will offer 7 seats.
Mm-hmm.
But it won't here.
Very strange. And I actually did point that out in my review as well, and I was confused by that. I suspect it's because they don't want this to take all the sales away from the Pajero.
Right.
You know, you can't just have one car that does everything, otherwise people won't buy anything else in your range. And the Pajero Sport is so much more modern than the Pajero. If it had a 7-seater as well, it would probably cut the grass of its bigger brother. But, you know, it's also a 5-seater has more cargo storage space. And if they obviously did a study and worked out that most of the buyers in this market don't really want a third row.
All right. Well, let's hope that the Pajero Sport keeps Mitsubishi in the game for the time being.
Melbourne's most lovable radio station, Joy 94.9.
That is so true. And I'd like to think we're some of the most lovable radio presenters in Melbourne as well. Silence from my co-presenters. They obviously think I'm talking utter rubbish.
That is the nicest thing anyone has ever said to me, Dan. Wow.
Really? Oh, God, that's sad, Mike. No. We'll have a talk after the show. While you were in Japan driving the Pajero Sport, I was also there driving a rival brand, sort of, kind of, not really at all. Another Japanese brand, Subaru. And they had laid on a special drive for a group of journalists from Australia, and only journalists from Australia. This was special because the Subaru brand is so highly regarded here that they decided to reward us Aussies and say, come and drive something that will be coming here, the Levorg. Now, love or hate the name? It's divided people.
It says grovel backwards.
Oh, nice. Don't say that because then I have to mention the Ford Focus, and we all know what that says backwards. Work it out for yourself, guys. Okay, so I was there to drive the Subaru Levorgue, and I'm just watching Kez Casey's face. He's working out what...
Trying to keep focus it together.
Yeah, don't worry.
The drop... Oh, wait, hang on. No, okay, yeah, go on.
I drove the Levorgue, and this car is basically... It's based on the WRX platform. Sorry, I'll say that properly. WRX platform, which is the sporty sedan we already have here. We also get it in an STI version, which is not sexually transmitted infection. It's Subaru Technica International. And... The Levorgue is basically a car that will come here and be an estate car or a wagon to replace what now we don't get, which is the Liberty Wagon. Now, it's slightly smaller, but Mitsubishi is making a point of saying this is not a WRX wagon. It's a replacement for the Liberty Wagon. So, with that in mind, they put us on basically a racing circuit. I'm like, hang on, guys. How are you telling us on the one hand this is appealing to practical people and people with families, and yet you're letting us drive like lunatics on a racing circuit? Actually, on that note, it wasn't a racing circuit for cars. This was probably the most interesting things about the trip. It was actually at a place called the Cycle Sports Centre, also near Mount Fuji. And on the day we went, Mike, it was beautiful. We had lovely views of it. And anyway, it wasn't actually a car track at all. It was a bike track. And it had been specially built, 6K long. It was almost like something out of, like, it was almost Soviet.
Push bike or motorbike?
Push bike.
Did you have to dodge people in Lycra as you were on your test?
No, that's what I wanted to know. Yeah. For us. It was a private track and there were no people allowed.
So there was no point scoring.
No, wouldn't have that been fun? No, that's not
maybe,
fun.
No.
No, we like cyclists on fender bender as well. They're the ones who do the bending of the fender. So we were on this circuit. It was 6Ks long and it was a really great technical circuit. But the frightening thing is, because it was for bikes, push bikes, there were no Armcos, no barriers, no runoffs, no gravel traps. It was one of the most terrifying things I've ever done in a car, I'll be completely honest. But thankfully, we had underneath us the new Subaru Levorgue, which has got the 2-litre turbocharged boxer 4 of the WRX. It also has the permanent four-wheel drive system of the WRX. I'm sorry, Subaru, I don't care what you say. I know you're going for Liberty Wagon, previous owners and fans, but this feels every bit like a wagon version of a WRX.
Which
and
they used to offer.
They used
or
to
like
offer.
Or like a hatch wagon kind of thing.
And I say that entirely to its credit. It is really good. It might not look quite as sporty on the outside. They might have left off some of the vents and the bright colours. It certainly looks a little bit more conservative, but when you get in the car, it's a wonderful drive. It's really good. It's got bags of grip. It's got tons of grunt from that lovely 2-litre boxer. I don't know what the fuel consumption is going to be like, because that is one of the main criticisms of the WRX. The thing that probably leans it more towards practicality rather than sport is it's only available with their CVT, which is their continuously variable transmission. No manual, unfortunately, which would be a really great combination in this car, in my opinion. The package overall is actually very good. It's coming to Australia. We'll be here in just a couple of months. Pricing and all that, I think, is yet to be announced. But it will be a really valuable addition to the Subaru range. And it was fantastic fun. Now, I did get into a little bit of trouble because another interesting thing about the trip was that they had the engineers on site as well. And all the journalists were giving it a damn good go. And it wasn't a particularly hot day, but two journalists, one of them, myself included, managed to break them. I didn't crash or anything. Because
this is why we can't have nice things.
And this is exactly why we can have nice things. Because the engineers came over and they suddenly started asking us all these questions. You know, how were you driving it? Were you in auto or manual mode with the CVT? You know, what sort of revs were you in? And they wanted to know all this information. And they went away and they said, we're going to sort this problem. And when it comes to Australia, you're not going to have... Virtually on that day, they said this car will come to Australia with a transmission oil cooler, and it doesn't get one here. So, thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I made the Levorgue better. When it arrives here, it will be improved, thanks to me.
You can send your letter of thanks to Dan. One of the things that the Levorgue has in Japan that you didn't mention, though, is a 1.6-litre turbo engine,
true.
Which is like a base model. It's not WRX-based at all. Are we going to get that in Australia?
No, we aren't.
That's disappointing.
Yeah, well, is it? Because it would just be, it'd be a bit slow, wouldn't
well,
it?
Well, it would be nice to see... It's a 1.6 turbo, so it's not going to be disgustingly slow. It will be like a normal mid-size-y or small hatch kind of competitor.
But we're Aussies,
but
we
I'd
love
really
power.
Like to see that engine rolled out across the rest of the range.
Okay, all right.
Just
well,
as
who
a
knows?
Replacement for their 2-litre naturally aspirated engine that they currently run.
Possibly.
That would have been the kind of the way to launch that, but... I guess, you know, well, if I have to have a performance wagon, so be it.
True. We're going to take a very short break, but before we go, I want to say thank you very much to the wonderful Betty, who's emailed in and says simply, cheeky, humorous, lovable, handsome presenters. What more can you say about the Fender Bender crew?
I'm
You're
blushing.
On Joy 94.9. You are listening to Fender Bender on Joy 94.9. Before the break, we were talking about Mike and my extravagant drive adventures in the land of the rising sun. But now we're coming back to the show. We had our little drive out, and then we went back to see all the wonderful things that were being exhibited. We did mention a couple of concepts before, but we're going to head back there now because Subaru, the company I was there with, I drove their Levorg, they released a concept of the Impreza, the next shape Impreza. Now, I had a chat to the director of the design department at Subaru, and he said, as we stood next to it, he said, the next Impreza will look like that. Come on,
Subaru has form. You remember, it's one of those companies that releases concept cars and then it releases the production versions, and they're quite watered down. It's happened before.
Yeah.
And it's something that companies often do. And Subaru has form in their department. So let's hope that it's really changed its stripes.
It's a really good looking thing. It's now gentleman, the director of design department, he said with the current shape Impreza, people love it for its practicality. They love the way it drives. They like all of its attributes, but it doesn't have any fun in it. And what they're trying to get back is that sense of fun, which the Impreza always had. You know, it came across as a really sort of, you know, sporting sedan and hatchback. So they're really going for that with this one. And I hope they keep it, because as with all concept cars, yeah, okay, the mirrors will be dropped and the door handles that are flush to the body, they'll be dropped as well. But there's actually, looking at it in person, there's not a lot that will prevent it going through in a pretty same likeness to production.
Production safe kind of shape. There's always concept car stuff that you won't see. It's got really pointy, cool LED headlights and taillights and things like that that'll get watered down. Like you say, the LED mirrors and door handles and maybe some different bumpers. But if it makes it through looking the way it did on the motor show stand, it will sell its socks off.
Excellent. Something else that was there, which we have talked about before, but we got a chance to see in person, is the Toyota Kikai. Now, Mike, you described this in a wonderful way. What did you say this looks like?
Oh, it looks a little bit like, do you remember the movie WALL-E?
Yes.
It looks like they've tried to make WALL-E, but they've kind of, it just melted a little bit or something. it's a weird little, it's the kind of car you'd only see in concept form, and it's the kind of car you'd only see at the Tokyo Motor Show. It looks a bit like a helicopter without a rotor, or a slightly melted WALL-E, or a motorbike that grew half a car body. It's inside out. It's got bits all over the top of it. It wouldn't pass pedestrian regulations
That would eat children alive.
It would. It's sort of like a little mini Japanese hot rod. And I don't know why Toyota did it. I really don't. Because concept cars are supposed to be about, you know, this is going to preview something we're going to do in the future, loosely.
This car
can never happen, and I don't get it.
I like the frivolous nature of it.
So Toyota describes it as showing the complex beauty of the mechanical aspects of cars.
There you go.
Which is a little bit too haiku for, you know, a Corolla, perhaps. But I think it's kind of cool. It's what a retro-futuristic hot rod kind of with a steampunk vibe might look like. It's guaranteed to make you car sick because it has windows at floor level so you can see the front suspension move.
Oh, weird.
And if you've ever been in a car where you can actually see the road going underneath you, you can do that for all of 2 minutes before you're about to hurl.
Really?
But like you say, there is not a single chance that this thing is even close to, you know, a production reality. It's just a bunch of designers who kind of went, you know what, let's have some fun on the company's account.
Here's why I have a beef, because Toyota has been saying forever it's going to make a super successor, and the more time it wastes spending money and time on concepts that will never go anywhere and never come to fruition is time it should be spending making a bloody Supra.
Well, maybe the Kikai is the new Supra. Maybe they've just decided, you know, to change up things a little bit, you know? You wanted a rear-drive, front-engined, fabulous sports coupe, but actually what we're going to give you is a tiny Jeep with all the suspension bits on the wrong side of the bodywork.
Bold.
Okay. Part of me really wants that to be the next Supra now.
Just to see the disappointment in the enthusiast's face.
Someone that wasn't disappointing is the good people at Lexus, with a concept they revealed called the LFFC, which is a vast car. It's bigger than a Mercedes S-Class. It's a hybrid at the moment, but they're saying that within 5 years, this car will be available running on a hydrogen fuel cell, which is exciting stuff, because now that's another contender. I mean, yes, I know Toyota already has the Mirai, which is a hydrogen fuel cell car, and Lexus is a sub-brand of Toyota, or at least under the same ownership, but that's another brand that you may potentially see running on a hydrogen fuel cell. And with more cars on the road or available in showrooms, that means the infrastructure gains pace, and we're looking more increasingly like we will have hydrogen fuel cells as an alternative energy source.
So I assume this previews the next generation LS, yes? Lexus's flagship S-Class rival.
I assume so.
And the LS was the first car Lexus ever did, the LS400 of 1989. So this is back to the future in a weird sort of way.
You almost sound a bit like Byron
there. I did, didn't I? But this is the car that made made Lexus. This is where the company began, and it was Lexus was quite revolutionary for its time. And so it's interesting for one reason, because it's a successor to that. It's interesting also because it's taking their spindle grille to new heights, that really distinctive, massive front maw that Lexuses have on them that you're going to love or hate. I fall into the latter category, for what it's worth. But other than that, it is a beautiful-looking concept. And the hydrogen thing is interesting. And it's really interesting because companies are starting to make their limo versions the cars that they experiment with a little more, just like they used to in the past. So the new Volkswagen Phaeton, for instance, will be electric only.
Wow.
This will be hydrogen. There'll probably be a petrol or a hybrid of some sort, you'd have to assume, but hydrogen will at least be offered. It's quite interesting to me that companies are kind of taking... It always was that the top-spec limo in your range was the car that you experimented with and everything trickled down from there, right? It sort of seems like Lexus is going back to that mold, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, I like that principle. I mean, that works well. I mean, look at all the other sort of premium brands. You start seeing technology that filters down into, you know, more affordable models, and that sort of works quite well, I think. And good on them. One other. Now, Nissan showed a concept called the IDS, which is now, I mean, emerging technologies. A lot of people talking about autonomy, particularly the Japanese. It looks like it nears ever closer by the day. We're talking about Land Rover, who's got, they've got a car which is autonomous off-road. Nissan's IDS is an electric car which is also self-driving. Another one of those. So, I mean, this is gaining momentum for the autonomous cause, with yet another brand weighing in with a concept that will perhaps, sooner maybe than we think, will be a production model.
Nissan's been on the cutting edge of autonomous cars for a long time. It's been one of the first to talk about 2020 as the date that it wants to release its first autonomous car. It's a bit vague as to what autonomy actually connotes, how much of it work it does by itself.
Yeah.
And there's a whole bunch of regulations to be negotiated and how you can safely do it. And there's a whole bunch of things that get in the way. But it doesn't change the fact. This is a beautiful car. It's got a revolutionary powertrain, and it essentially does drive itself. And that's exactly what a concept car should be, right?
Absolutely. And another one that drives itself is Mercedes Vision Tokyo. Now, this is interesting because it's a German brand that's decided to debut a concept in Japan, which is, you know, not totally not done, but it's unusual. It's a bit unorthodox. Now, this thing, the Vision Tokyo, reminds me a little bit of the F015, which was that another autonomous kind of bubble-looking car. This one has gone a stage further. There's no front row. There's no driver's seat. There's no option to drive it whatsoever. It's basically just a lounge on wheels. All the seats face in. It's basically, right, imagine those awful stretch limos you get to cheap nightclubs. Imagine getting one of those and taking away the driver and front passenger seat. It's basically a row of seats that all face inwards, and you can all have a gay old time. Just, you know, chatting to your friends, you know, and having a couple of drinks maybe. I don't know, there's probably legislation that stops you doing that. But this is a really interesting autonomous concept because it entirely takes away your ability to drive the car. It is just self-driving.
Well, all the talk about vehicle autonomy says that there's always going to be the ability for the driver to intercept and drive if they want. A bit like a plane flies on autopilot, but you have a pilot there just to take over in certain circumstances. And I think people want that. I think people love the idea of not having to drive in peak hour traffic, but they also want the ability to take over and grab the wheel if the proverbial hits the fan. So I don't know whether this is the answer, but it's definitely Mercedes' way of showing the world how advanced its technology
is. It's pushing those limits. And then very quickly, Mike, I want to round out the concept discussion with a car that you had a first-hand experience of. Tell us the name, because not because I'm handing over and doing that good, you know, presenter thing. I just can't pronounce it.
Oh, I know what you're talking about. I was a bit mystified for a second then. The Toyota Gozai Flesby.
I'm sorry, that is not a name anything should be called.
Toyota Gozai is a company famous for lighting LEDs, etc., etc. Part owned by Toyota, but not quite Toyota. Toyota. Anyway, this thing is coated in what can only be described as wetsuit material. I don't really know why. I assume it's for pedestrian safety. Has a bunch of air bubbles under the skin that can push out and pull in and change the fundamental shape of the car.
That's so weird.
So it twists and bends and looks weird. And I actually bumped into the guy who designed it on the stand, who was just standing around and had a chat, and he showed me all the cool things that it can do. But A, it's called the Flesby, and B, it's coated in wetsuit material. I mean, if that doesn't define the Tokyo Motor to show, what the hell does?
Absolutely,
it's perfect.
Absolutely right. And on that wonderful, iconic Tokyo note, gentlemen, we have to wind things up. We've had so much to talk about. I'm so sorry to our listeners who are listening in for any production cars, because we could have talked about the Toyota SFR, we could have talked about the Subaru S207, which is a 241 kilowatt tuned version of the WRX STI. We could have talked about the Porsche Macan GTS, we could have talked about the Subaru Forester TS, but we didn't, because what we're going to have to do is just wait for them to arrive on our home soil, and then we will drive them and we will bring them all to you guys on Fender Bender on John 94.9. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me in the studio again to give us all your wonderful Tokyo exploits.
Domo arigato gozaimasu.
What he said.
Excellent. I always love when Mike gets back from an international trip. He speaks phrases for about the next week afterwards and in perfect pronunciation and nicely done. Gentlemen, we will see you very soon on Fender Bender. My name has been Daniel Gardner and it will be after the show. I don't know why people give it that funny context. Next week, Tim Nicholson will be back to take the helm. Coming up next is the fabulous Birthday Hannah. She's 16 today and she will be bringing you another excellent episode of Cute. So stick with Joy 94.9. This is Fender Bender signing off. Drive safely.
This has been a Fender Bender podcast for Joy 94.9, Australia's first and only gay and lesbian radio station. See joy.org.au for more details.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.